Hey, Coach. Welcome to the Basketball Podcast. I'm your host, Chris Oliver. Let's share the game.
Coach, it's great to have JP Nervin with us today. JP is a coach and a coach mentor that specializes in transformational leadership. He's the host of the Coaching Culture Podcast and the author of a great book called Calling Up, Discovering Your Journey to Transformational Leadership. And JP, thanks to you, I've had a chance to read that book. Great stuff. And I've had a chance to be on your podcast, listen to your podcast, and just tremendous sharing going on. So welcome to our podcast.
Yeah, well, it's awesome to be on the Basketball Immersion Podcast because I know it's impacted a lot of the coaches that I've gotten to work with as well.
Well, and you're a basketball guy, and certainly coaches, I encourage you to go look into JP's background. But what I like about listening to you and hearing a lot of your concepts is a lot of them are practical. They're rooted in experience, and that's because you played and you coached. Is that partly by design that you've been able to move into this area of mentorship and sharing ideas about leadership, et cetera, because you've had all these practical experiences?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I guess my playing experience highly influenced my coaching experience and also some of my many coaching failures. I was fortunate. I played basketball through up high school, and then it was a walk-on at University of South Carolina when I know another one of your guests in the podcast recently, Dave Odom, was my coach there for a season. But I think one of the ways that I'm able to connect with so many coaches is because I've been through it. I've made many of the same mistakes, and I've faced many of the same challenges when it comes to really building that team culture. And I've coached over in Ireland, spent some time in Lithuania, and then on Tennessee and Pennsylvania. So I've been around the place, been around the game, coached professionals, coached high school athletes, probably my number one area of coaching.
There's such a huge difference between sympathy and empathy. And it's great that when you talk to coaches, you can empathize with them, no doubt. And I want to start somewhere and get right into a whole bunch of things, because I know we can use your expertise to really help coaches stimulate their thinking. The area I want to start with is one of my focuses on creating struggle or desirable difficulties for my players. But the piece that I think is often missing for coaches is to also give them coping strategies to be able to handle going through this struggle, which is necessary for learning. Can you talk a little bit about some of the emotional strategies, the emotional things that you help players? Let's first focus on players. Help them understand, to be able to guide them through the process.
Yeah, absolutely. So when it comes to players, since we're focusing there first, I mean, you mentioned empathy, and I think that's a big piece of it, is that in moments where a player is struggling, whether it be within a game or even off the court, it's really, really important that they feel seen and they feel heard. That's like one of the biggest things right off the bat there. And so I think so often as a coach, my mistake was when I would have a player that would come, maybe I subbed him off, or after a really bad practice or after a heated exchange, I would come in with a logical argument, and I would try to present this argument of what they should have done in that situation, or why what they did was unacceptable, or how they just needed to get it together. They need to pull it together. And that's really not speaking to their emotional part of their brain. And so we really need to come in, and actually it's listening, how we listen. And we really talk about a term that I took from Chris Voss, who is an FBI negotiator. He talks about tactical empathy. And when we're connecting and empathizing, we use things like open questions, where we're just, what's going on, you know, what happened out there. We're just really asking questions to help them articulate, so that we show understanding, not necessarily acceptance of what, you know, always maybe how they might have reacted to it, but we show understanding of their struggle. The other big thing is he talks about is labeling. You know, just, hey, it seems like you're really frustrated, or it seems like it's really, really challenging for you right now, because of, and then just kind of what that situation, because the referees have just called three straight fouls on you, or whatever it be that really seems to have been that trigger. So I think one of the first things I would suggest to coaches is how we listen. You know, really active listening, very intentional through our use of questions, is really important. The other thing, big thing, is to help a player identify their triggers. So often it's the same thing that is triggering that player, a certain type of scenario. And we have to help them in the moment. One of my favorite psychologists, Daniel Siegel, talks about name it to tame it. I mean, this is a popular psychology term when it comes to understanding how the brain works, but we want them to be able to name what is bothering them in that moment. And that just by naming that fear, that anxiety, that stress, that actually brings our stress levels down. That brings our heart rate down so that we're more regulated. So if we can help through our questioning, through our discussions, get players to name what is going on, that's a great first step. But then we have to follow that up. And I think a lot of times that's off the court. That's in our one-on-one conversations. That's in our assistant coach on the edge of the bench, you know, having that conversation with, okay, we get it. This is a trigger. How will you respond the next time? And I think this is a big third component, is getting guys to identify their triggers, have a level of self-awareness. And once they kind of admit those, admit that they want to change, identify how they should respond. And there's kind of a level of visualization, you know, a level of visualization here. I got a coach that has spent, I'd say probably more time this year going over things, how they were going to respond when things don't go well, than going over the game plan, right? Because he understands that that's what triggers bad refereeing, shots not falling. That's what sets his team off and throws them off their game plan. So they talk more about how they'll respond when things don't go the way they want them to go. And that's been incredibly powerful as well.
Well, I think a lot of coaches understand the value of psychology, mental training, mental toughness, whatever all these words are, but the practicality of it is what's missing. So I'm so happy you added some practical things to this. And then for coaches, a similar process, but what's different maybe for coaches in terms of managing their emotions?
Yeah, I think this is really, really, really important. I'm really passionate about it. And I try to break things down into kind of three simple steps or three simple ways to do it. So I'll do it kind of similar here with coaches. And I think there's a level of awareness. My biggest struggle as a coach was that I often used my personality as an excuse for my behavior. And I think there has to be a level of awareness to realize that just because something seems natural or even potentially authentic does not necessarily mean that it's right. The other thing is it always effective? Well, me having an emotional response, going absolutely ballistic in a huddle or a timeout or on the sidelines, sometimes that may drive the immediate short-term effects that we're looking for. But if we're trying to build a culture, not every coach is, but if we're trying to build a culture that is largely more player-led than traditionally, than most traditional programs where we're currently at, if we're trying to build a culture where players are intrinsically motivated, where they feel, and also we really want to have a culture where people feel connected and respected, then short-term interventions as a coach, emotional outbursts like that to get the results we want, really, really hurts our ability to build that player-led, intrinsically motivated culture. So we have to have a level of awareness of, okay, I understand that this is my kind of default response, but I have to work on that. And I'm big about helping people move from personality to character. And so I had to really make a lot of changes there. So the big first thing was I had a level of awareness. And I remember when I first encountered that level of awareness that really hit me was my wife challenged me to actually watch film of myself, because I was at a game or I was a varsity coach and I went and watched our freshman coach. And my freshman coach, I sat right behind the bench. He was going absolutely ballistic. And I got so annoyed by how loud he was the entire game. And I remember turning to my wife going, oh my gosh, would he ever be quiet? And she goes, you should hear yourself. And that was like, oh boy. So then she's like, you seriously, just film yourself. So I filmed myself, listened to myself. And it was, wow, man, that I don't really know exactly how much my players actually even listen to me when I'm constantly standing and shouting and going, like if they just tune you out. So I had a level of awareness. My personality, I'm a very intense, very passionate person. I wear my heart on my sleeve and I still want to be authentic and true to that self, that person. But I know if, for my team to be at their best, to create the culture I want, and actually to help my players to cope or regulate their own emotional responses, I had to make changes. How did I make those changes? Well, I would say this would be two big things. The first was I actually started to chart, and this is seems a little bit crazy, but there was a week, probably maybe like 2 weeks, where I, over the course of 4 or 5 games, I was charting. I used to have just something, a little note card, kind of had my game plan on it and on my play calls. And every time I spoke, I was literally charting under one category of whether that was in line with who I wanted to be or that wasn't in line with who I wanted to be in that moment. It's just kind of like a positive negative. I don't like to use positive negatives. I think it dumbs it down. But I was just really, really hypercritical of myself. in those moments and kind of charting and just constantly trying to pull myself to a level of awareness. That was really impactful for me. It worked for me. The other thing was I just had open conversations with my staff and some of my players that I trusted. And I said, hey, I'm working on this because I understand based upon your feedback and some of my own personal reflection that the way that I'm coaching is not what is really necessary or effective for us as a team long-term. So I need you in those moments to give me feedback in this way. And I kind of gave them a prescription, a pat on the back or arm around me. And just, it's kind of the words that I needed to hear in that moment to kind of pull me back and help me become more grounded. And what that did was incredible because not only was I getting coaching, right? Which we give our players coaching all the time. We need coaching. Who's coaching us? Well, my players, my assistants were helping to coach me. But I was showing them that I was willing to change. I was willing to grow. So when I started to turn around and ask them to pull it together, I tried to help them and I started challenging their own behaviors. They were much more receptive.
It's great stuff. And I reflect upon my personal challenges in this area. And I was aware. And I think that was a strength that I was aware that I was coaching often a way that I didn't want to coach. And I'm going to get to a point with that. But I left practice or I left moments and I said, I didn't want to do that. I didn't want to respond that way, emotionally aggressive, competitive, however I justified it. So I was aware. What about the challenge for some coaches or the media portrayal of coaches, whatever it may be, about justifying hard coaching because you're successful? Like, this is my personality. We're successful. This is how I'm doing it. But in those examples, is there research? Is there evidence? Do you have opinion on it? Like, players just overcame it. It's not, they didn't succeed because of the hard coaching. And in fact, they probably overcame it and that helped develop some resiliency because they learned how to cope with it. Is that my right thinking?
Yeah, I think that I'm sitting here actually reading the last few days, Getting to Us by Seth Davis. And he goes through a lot of those coaches and are really hard coaches. I'd say first off, those coaches are still really great at a lot of other things, right? That are really, really tough and emotional. And I think that they're really exceptional in so many areas that players, like you said, they can survive it and they can win or they can be successful in spite of it. They can have good relationships in spite of that, right? And I think that that's, you know, I challenge because I think I know that really helping to connect with players in those moments to be under control, in my opinion, it sacrifices some of that relationship. And it's not just actually my opinion though. I mean, on my podcast, we just had recently the world leading trauma psychologist, Dr. Bruce Perry, who's worked on cases and with Columbine shooting and Waco, Texas and Oklahoma City bombing. He's been on 60 Minutes with Oprah. And I mean, he pretty much said it straight out. Coaches are selling themselves short if they are constantly responding to players or coaching players in a dysregulated state, because a dysregulated adult will never help regulate another person. Like, you'll just never help somebody else really, truly. And what people do, they play through it.
I love that. Can you say that again? I love that phrasing.
Yeah, a dysregulated adult will never regulate another person.
This relates to brain science, right? This is brain science that studies this and looks at that, right? It's not just anecdotal evidence.
Yes. I mean, you think about what's happening emotionally within a player, right? In the heat of the game, where our greatest stress comes from, where our greatest anxiety, it comes from a constant need to prove ourselves, right? There's so much there out there. There's that whether we're on the free throw line or we're in the big game or whatever it is, like, they're already enduring some levels of stress. That's what's so awesome. Sports provide an incredible environment of stress where players can work through that, grow through that stress, and that builds resilience, right? And that's what's so powerful about it. But it only grows if they're able to cope through it. But if they're having an emotional response, and I don't want to go too deep into this, but there's the brain science of the amygdala is having this reaction and it's heightened. It literally cuts off the connections from the lower to the upper parts of our brain. Our lower parts of our brain is the emotional basic fight or flight response. And the upper parts being the higher cognitive thinking. So if we really want players that can think, that can respond, if their amygdala is firing or their stress response is going crazy through the roof, the lower part can't actually communicate to the upper part. And so how do we help them to start to communicate lower and upper parts of the brain? That's purely down to so much of our ability to respond and help connect with them on some of the stuff that I shared earlier. That's just really, really important. And this is where I think, you know, when coaches talk about, well, I can't do it like I used to, right? You know, I can't coach players as hard as I used to.
Isn't it funny they say that like it's a bad thing?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a couple reasons that this perception is formulated though, Chris. And I think one of them is, I just don't think there was a level of awareness or conversation around actually what was going on. Right. I think we're much more just, we know, I mean, the last 25 years, brain science has shown us so much. I mean, it's incredible what it's shown us. Also, just now as we have researched the effects of some of these type of more transactional type of coaching behaviors to that argument. I think the second thing really is, comes down to, we get away with it. We get away with this for so long on a certain level. Players maybe are shutting down in some aspects to us, but they maybe fought through it in the past because they had more emotional intelligence. We are suffering as the newer generations are suffering from a lack of emotional intelligence. That's largely based upon upbringing and the influence of technology. There's a lot of research to back that up, okay, that the impact of technology. And we can all just from our own personal experience know that the impact on our players. Because we have players with less emotional intelligence, they're less able and equipped to be able to deal with that type of coaching.
For most of my career, I struggled with this. And I'm saying, in all honesty, I would have been a better coach if I learned how to manage my emotions, not be reactionary. And again, for new coaches, old coaches, whatever, this is a learned process. You can develop this. And I love that you added the charting and watching yourself. There's nothing more impactful than that. And it's a famous kind of, I can't remember Tiger Woods' original mental skills coach, but talked about having him do paper clips in one pocket. And then when he had a negative thought, he moved them into the other pocket. And it comes back to the thing that you've said already, which is so important, awareness. When you become aware of this, and you become aware, first of all, that you're doing this, that's the first step towards changing.
Yeah. And I just want to add this too. It's kind of an argument for it because I know some coaches are still going, but you know, that guy, he does it. They're winning. The type of coaching that I'm a big advocate for is not just about getting results, though this is going to help you improve your results, I think, but also just really, are you developing the person? We want to develop emotional intelligence. To do that, we have to connect with them in those emotional moments. But also, I think a large argument is, I have against this type of coaching, which I was a big coach in, like I was very emotional. It was just like that. This is sports. This is the way, you know, this is the way it goes. But honestly, there's few other leadership positions in any other profession where we can speak to employees or teach can speak to students in that type of way. Now I get it. It's competition and there's certain boundaries that maybe are a little bit more grayer and can be moved back a little bit. But I think from an ethical standpoint, I think we have to look at it that way as well.
Well, it comes back to athlete experiences as well. And I think we value that more, but we're still struggling with this. And I look at this and go, okay, look, I get it. You've been successful, but think about changing for the good of the sport and service of the sport and service of your athletes. Because our problem moving forward is retention of players in the sport of basketball, not moving to other sports or not dropping out if we're talking about youth level. And then everyone talks about this epidemic at the NCAA level of transfers. Well, I get it. Playing time probably is up there with the number one reasons, but also, do they enjoy playing in your program? And that's got to be a part of it. Is there athlete satisfaction? And I know I attack this from a practice perspective, and you attack this, again, not just for practice, from this holistic approach to, are they having a transformational versus transactional experience? Can you talk about transformational?
Yeah, absolutely. So when it comes to a transactional thing, I guess, and I don't like to really kind of name names or anything, so I'm not going to do that, but there's so many of us as coaches and myself in this conversation here, especially as I started to experience success, I felt a need or a compulsion to build off of that success, not even replicate it, right? I had to continue to build off that. As more and more attention drew to me, as more and more people thought of me as a good coach, successful coach, whatever, I felt like I had to prove that. And in that desire to prove ourselves, I think often coaching becomes very transactional. I don't think anybody gets into coaching because of that. I think we get into coaching because we love the sport. We know it's made a positive impact on our lives. We enjoy the sport. Also, we want to make an impact on people's lives. But I think we get caught up on this rise to the top or this constantly looking to prove ourselves. And then coaching becomes transactional. It becomes, what do I need to do to get more out of this kid, to validate myself, to so that we can win more games, essentially the bottom line of it often. And I really try to, I remember hearing a TED talk years ago where this guy, a comedian, Michael Jr., talked about how his mindset shifted from going and giving a comedy show, looking to get laughs, to looking to give laughs. That really, really resonated with me. If you look it up, Michael Jr., TED Talk, it's phenomenal. And it really is kind of what I advocate for us as coaching and transformational coaching is we need to go out there and look to give an, like you said, an experience that they're going to remember. Give them an experience that's going to help them to grow as people. And I think that's really a really important aspect of it is that, and this comes back to this whole idea of you may actually make sacrifices in the short term. Like the transactional coach can be effective, but if you want, like, but that's all extrinsic motivation. And you want to talk about other science, the science around extrinsic versus intrinsic motivation. Well, transactional coaching is so extrinsic. It's so carrots and sticks. It's rewards and punishments constantly. Transformational coaching is rooted in helping people to identify who they want to be as a team, who they want to be as a player, who they want to be as a person, and then helping them discover what it looks like to get there. And that's one of the most foundational conversations we have as within our with the teams that I work with, and also in the one-on-ones that a coach has with a player. Like, what are your aspirations for your sport? Who do you want to be as a player? You know, and eventually moving it towards the person. But then, what do we got to do to get there? You know, how can I help you in that process? And so that's really what the core is. The transformational coach isn't forcing or coercing or trying to control people. He's empowering people. Or he or she is empowering people to really realize their potential.
So let's rephrase this. So here's a transactional statement. If you don't do this, I will sub you. The transaction is obviously you do this or else. Give me a way to rephrase that in a transformational setting.
Big time is, I think I would advocate for two big things. One is there are certain things that you're just going to have to set as coach standards or expectations. Like, for instance, within the game, within your practice environment, just some basic non-negotiables. But I think a big thing is also to have players establish what is acceptable behavior. I know you've had my favorite guests that's been on your podcast is Mark Bennett. And he uses the words acceptable and acceptable. And if they're able to identify, in most cases, players are pretty hard on themselves and their teammates. They're able to identify unacceptable things. Then you agree upon potentially consequences within the game. So certain behaviors, certain ways to reacting, what's going to be the best way to move forward? If you demonstrate that unacceptable behavior, then you can ask a few questions. What would you do if you were the coach? What do we need to have happen here for us to kind of hold each other accountable here? And how can we just kind of support you to kind of come back to that? So when it comes to subbing guys out, whether it be a lack of execution or a certain behavior on the court, we really advocate having a conversation beforehand that equips them with what's going to happen when they come out of that game and how we're going to support them to get back in that game. But they have to be an acceptable one on that bench, which we define those behaviors of, you know, being engaged, communicating, cheering on their teammates. So it's a little bit more nuanced than just like a one sentence, one liner here. You've really got to have a conversation with your team and establish some standards around the play and or some success criteria, which I know I think Alan Keene's been on your podcast. I love his terminology there as you go into the game. And these are instant outs. And it's because you guys are holding each other accountable to that.
Well, and I love the way you phrase it and put that together. And the way I interpret that then in terms of that statement, if you don't do this, I will sub you. It's really the difference between making it a punishment versus making it a teaching opportunity or an improvement for the team or improvement for the individual, right? Like it's transforming the meaning of what that means for them.
Yes. And you've just hit on something that I probably should have said right off the bat, which is when we're doing from a transactional, it's about rules and punishment, like just to use those terms. But if we move from more of a transformational standpoint, it's boundaries and consequences is the terminology we use. The difference is rules and punishment are, I'm doing this to you. Boundaries and consequences are, you're doing that to yourself. Like we identified how we want to play. We identified who we want to be. You're choosing to not do those things. So you're choosing to come out of the game. I'm not choosing, you're choosing. So that's huge. Like that's when it comes down to a transformational type of discipline, that is a game changer, because you are also in those moments, you're empowering them. They have a sense of control in that, a sense of personal responsibility. And they're less likely to constantly come back at, well, he was, you know, he didn't like me. And you know, that narrative that kids often tell themselves.
So moving into that area then a little bit, and let's talk about discipline and say consequences. So I'm sure you get asked this all the time, like I do. Well, you know, if the consequence isn't running in practice, what is it that's going to have a meaningful impact?
Yeah, well, I'll preface this with, this is really tough. Right. And I think a lot of times coaches talk about, oh, that guy's a tough coach. He gets on his guys and yell, like, no, this is tougher. Like, this is harder to do. But when coaches do this type of discipline, there's a resounding, my gosh, it just feels better. Doesn't make it easy, but it feels a lot better as a coach, because it's honestly, it's more authentic, I think, with who we really want to be. So when it comes to the alternatives to running or conditioning, there's a big underlying philosophical argument against that. And that first one is, well, conditioning and that stuff is supposed to be good for guys, and yet we're making it as a consequence. So there's kind of like that conflicting message that we've been sending for decades and decades and decades in coaching. But when it comes to these consequences, the way we enforce is, first off, we better make sure that that boundary or that standard has been communicated well, whether that's coming from us as a coach standard or the players, the teams have set the standard. It needs to come there. That needs to be very, very clear. We talked about some ways to support, ways to connect with guys, you know, a little bit earlier in the podcast. And we got a plethora of ways to help guys to self-assess in that moment. So we're not just jumping on a guy right away if he's not giving a great effort, or his attitude is dipped, or he's caught up in the last play, or he's arguing with referees. We're not just instantly in with the consequence, but we're providing support and our advocacy before accountability is what I call it. Like, we need that support before we come with the accountability. So we're using those type of things at different stages as well. When it comes to that accountability, those consequences, one of the most powerful things is you've lost the opportunity to get better. You've lost the privilege to play. So we talk about progressive consequences. Kind of share a real quick story about my upbringing. I love basketball. Basketball was everything to me. School had no interest in it. My parents, when I was in sixth grade, did something that has had a profound impact on me, I think really on my character for the rest of my life. And I still thank them for it this day, which was, I got a C in one of my classes in sixth grade. Now, my parents were like, A's and B's, that's our standard. It was very, very much communicated. Well, got that C, I sat that Friday night basketball game. And that was devastating for me. It was against our best opponent. I still remember it very, very well. The coach was upset, the players, the teammates, the parents, everybody else upset. I was one of the best players there. They wanted me, but I missed it. Well, I made the same mistake as a seventh grader. Got an F in my Latin class, still remember it. Got pulled off the football team. My parents just said, you got to get that grade up. Now, my parents did not beg. They did not plead. They did not complain. There was none of that. They were not screaming. There was no fighting matches. It was just like, you got the grade. You chose to not do your work. So now you're going to sit out until that grade comes up. But then my mom proceeded to sit with me every night and help me study with flashcards and stuff, and help me bring that grade up. And why I tell this story is because it did a few things. First off, it's a great demonstration that we don't need to beg or plead or complain to get, you know, our guys to do things or use shame or anger. My parents just set a standard around something that was really important to me, and they forced it. But then they helped me. They helped me those moments. They helped me to bring my behavior back up to acceptable. So that had a big impact on me, because never again did my parents have to enforce that consequence again, because I got it. I also understood it was my choice, but it also did something, and I think in my character, that was really important. I saw basketball as a privilege, as something that I was not entitled to for the rest of my life. I think it really impacted my work ethic. It just a mental shift in me. It wasn't something, oh, I'm good at this, so I get to play it. It's like, I'm good at this, I love this, I have to do what I need to do though to earn that opportunity to play this game. So when it comes to enforcing discipline, one of the most powerful things we can say as a coach is, hey, you've lost the opportunity to get better in this drill. I'll see you in the next drill. You don't run them. You just, hey, this drill is supposed to be good for you. You said you want to be a good basketball player. So just hop off there. We'll see you in the next drill.
And for coaches listening, I mean, beyond your book and everything else, just Google natural and logical consequences versus punishment. And it's essentially what you're saying is there's a logical and non-natural consequence rather than something that's completely out of the realm of, you know, what we're talking about, and that's a punishment in terms of that. So, and there's ways to balance that. And we're not saying don't ever run them, don't ever punish them, right? Like that's sometimes a part of it, because you talked about already that potentially yelling once in a while is effective because it can shock them. I imagine the same thing with running. But if you do it all the time, it becomes meaningless to them.
Hey, coach, just a brief interruption from the podcast to hear from one of our supporters, LinkedIn. The perfect hire can have an impact on your business for years to come. So when you need to find that next person to help grow your business, LinkedIn Jobs will match the right talent with your open role fast. I personally use LinkedIn, and I know many of you in the coaching profession do too. Did you know LinkedIn has over 675 million members worldwide? LinkedIn Jobs screens candidates with the hard and soft skills you're looking for so you can hire the right person fast. Things like collaboration, creativity, adaptability. LinkedIn looks beyond the work skills and puts your job post in front of qualified candidates who match your business requirements perfectly. That's how LinkedIn makes sure your job post is seen by the people you want to hire, people with the skills, qualifications, and other interests that will help your business grow. It's no wonder a person is hired every 8 seconds with LinkedIn. Find the right person for your business today with LinkedIn Jobs. You can pay what you want and get the first 50 off. Just visit linkedin.com/team. Again, that's linkedin.com/team to get $50 off your first job post. Terms and conditions apply. With home security, there's two ways you can go about protecting your home. There's the traditional way, where you wait weeks for a technician to do a messy installation that costs a small fortune. Or there's the other way, SimpliSafe. SimpliSafe is everything you need in a home security system. It's award-winning protection, 2-time winner of CNET Editor's Choice Award. SimpliSafe blankets your whole home in safety. You get comprehensive protection for your entire home. Outdoor cameras and doorbells alert you to anyone approaching your home. Entry, motion, and glass break sensors guard inside. You barely notice it's there. But what's truly remarkable is you can set up this system all by yourself. Anyone can do it. It takes 30 minutes to an hour tops, and there's absolutely no trade-offs to your safety. You'll have an army of highly trained security experts ready to dispatch police to your home at a moment's notice 24/7. And it's only 50 cents a day with no contracts. It's why The Verge calls SimpliSafe the best home security system. Go to simplisafe.com/team today and you'll get free shipping and a 60-day risk-free trial. You've got nothing to lose. Go now and be sure you go to simplisafe.com/team. That's simplisafe.com/team. Now back to the podcast.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the big thing is a lot of times you have them establish their consequences, which before they go into it, like, hey, if we're not at the level that we say we need to be at, you know, what do you think would be a good consequence for this? I think that's really, really powerful. We do this with teams preseason. When they establish standards, we talk about, you know, okay, but what if we don't meet them? How are you, you know, obviously you're responsible for yourself. Then we talk about being responsible to each other. But as a coach, when we have to step in and we have to intervene, what should that look like? And I ask this to teams all the time, college level, Division I, Division II, Division III, high school, across the board. And everyone consistently, kids don't know what to say. They honestly are run us, but they know that's like, they're not like crazy about it. You know, they get on us, or, you know, just kick us out of practice, all that type of stuff. And they're really uncomfortable with that. And we actually have conversations with them. We say, well, what would hurt more? You missing out on playing, getting better, or me running you? And nearly unanimously, guys are like, oh, I would hate to have to sit out of practice. You know, it really, honestly, it stings and it hurts more too, though. So I'm a big advocate of steering away from that. But yeah, I also believe like allowing them to sometimes choose consequences within a practice or something like that for a certain drill, if they don't make the mark or if things dip below that effort, that it, especially when it comes from them, it can be effective too. And it's still intrinsic in that environment.
Okay, let's shift gears a little bit. Great stuff. And let's get into a little bit, how do you restart your culture if you realize it's not what you want?
Yeah, I don't know many of us that feel like it really is ever what we want exactly. But I think, yeah, there's a lot of coaches out there. So that's a great question of how do we restart it? I love the story from David Avershoff's book, It's Your Ship. It's a book I highly recommend. He was a Navy ship captain. He took over USS Benfold, I believe, back in 99 or 2000. It was the worst ship in the Navy. It had the worst culture in all of the Navy. As far as retention, the Navy already had a pretty abysmal rate of like 50% of sailors were returning after a duty. This ship had only 20%. So he took over the worst ship in the Navy, and about a year and a half, he turned it around to the highest performing ship in the entire Navy. And he did it with the same sailors. He didn't kick everybody off the boat and get a bunch of new guys and recruit them in. He did it with those people. And I love this story because I think it kind of alludes to where we start. He brought in on day one, he had 400, I think almost 80 people. And of those 480, he interviewed every one of them. And he sat every one of them down and he said, what do you enjoy about being on the ship? What don't you enjoy? If you were the captain of the ship, what would you change? Well, if you were the captain, what would you change? He asked him those three questions. And if he really liked the suggestion and thought it could be implemented, he would get on the microphone or the speaker and he'd say, all right, thanks to Private Chris there, we are now doing whatever like this. He was just making all these small changes. And what he was really doing was he was implementing Toyota's philosophy of Kaizen, which is, you know, and people talk about Kaizen. I know it's in the Celtics weightlifting facility that Brad Stevens brought it in there. And it's, I think that's been misinterpreted as with, like 1% improvements every day. Kaizen at Toyota was founded on anybody on the line could press the red button, stop the process and make a suggestion, and they were going to implement it. They implemented 100% of their employees' suggestions. Now, I'm not necessarily advocating for 100% implementation just to restart your culture, but what I am advocating is two different types of gathering feedback. One is one-on-one exit interviews or entrance interviews, asking similar questions. What do you enjoy? What don't you enjoy? And if you could change anything, what would you change? I think that's one of them. And I think also using Google Forms to gather feedback is a really, really important piece, because some people just aren't going to be transparent at that stage, especially if you have a really struggling or toxic culture. And you might get some more feedback from anonymous surveys. Now, I had a coach that did one of those the other day, and he was really, really sickened by some of the feedback he got. But as we went through it, I just said, hey, man, this is information. And some of this is not valid, but they still feel and think this way. So now you have to address, why do they feel and think that way? Even if it's totally off base, their judgments or their assessment of your culture, you still need to get in there and understand why they feel and think that way, because that's part of your culture.
I've done Google Forms, and we talked about it on the podcast that we did together. And many conversations, these one-minute conversations, many conversations are just so important. And they're so easy to do. I mean, we always think culture is formed in these meetings, massive meetings. And really, it's these daily conversations, right, that are the most important.
Yeah. And you know, probably one of the guys that I've been working with this year, he took this and implemented this in a level that I didn't really suggest. He took it and run with it because I had been talking about Google Forms. I think he was sending every day a Google Form out to his players, basically just maybe three questions, like what's their mood, how they're feeling today, maybe how many hours they slept. And the third question was, is there anything that I need to know or the staff need to know about today when it comes to coaching you? And 95% of the kids would, no, nothing, all's good. But you think about, there's 5% of the time people are articulating stuff that he's able to quickly review in an Excel or the Google Sheets form, which takes all of 30 seconds to review it. And he's able to identify, oh my gosh, this kid had something happen here in his day, or he's injured, or you know, you're just approaching problems. And then he could get to those guys and have one-on-one conversations. And he's been a really good success story of the Google Forms and the use of that. His players didn't seem to really mind it either, because it only took them, they get the link every day, they take 30 seconds to fill it out, you know?
I've seen a number of teams this year post-practice do rate of perceived exertion. They walk around and they ask a player, say 1 out of 10, how they feel after practice. So it's a physical assessment. Just as easy to do that from a practice perspective in terms of psychological well-being, feeling, stuff like that. And the coach can't do it. This was not done by the coach. It was done by someone independent. But there's another aspect of it that I do believe in, that daily assessment of how players are feeling, what's going on. And it's not just physical.
Yeah. And I think so often, I know myself, I get so caught up going into a practice with like the practice plan. And I'm preparing mentally for all the tactical and technical stuff that I need to cover in that session. And what do we got to do to get ready for Friday's game? Things like this help us to consistently touch base with our players on a personal level. And for people like myself who sometimes struggle with certain guys on the one-on-one conversations you're talking about, I'm not often the greatest listener, especially with some of the generations and the things that, you know, finding topics that we share in common. This is just one way to help maybe bridge that gap, I think, is to find ways to check in with your guys on that personal level.
Love it. Love it. Some practical things for sure. And then how do you manage the needs of the group with the needs of individuals when developing culture?
That's huge. I think that's something I think I struggle a lot, because I think it changes as you move forward. As you move up the ranks, right? You know, and your job is more on the line and stuff, right? I think maybe at a little younger age is, in the underages, you can maybe focus a little bit more on just really each individual. But there comes a point where, you know, I think in, I'd say 75% of the coaches I work with this year have considered, man, I really want to help this kid. I really want to work with this kid. I really want to be able to bring him along. But he's just, or she is just not getting with the program. And that's where I think it's so important that we have a defined real purpose as a coach. We understand what our purpose is. We also understand our objective, winning games, winning championships, but our purpose. And that purpose is usually something around serving the players, helping the players grow, helping them to have a great experience. And we have to really identify situations where players maybe are keeping us from living that out, keeping us from creating the environment and the culture. And so putting the team's needs sometimes first, that is, you know, if they're really making you choose, honestly, I think sometimes you have to make some hard calls on that. I actually don't know if that was exactly what the answer was you were looking for though.
No, I mean, again, like, just, it's interesting to hear thoughts, because, and I think in a lot of ways, I mean, for me, parenting, it evolves quite a bit. And certainly within my teams is this, the differences between fairness and equality, right? Like that, this, like if we're talking about the individual, then we're not necessarily talking about everything being equal for every person, but we want it to be fair. And that seems to be a key part of this building culture, is that some players do need to be treated differently.
Yeah, I would highly agree with that. And I think what is important is if there's anything you're able to really do in team meetings. No, I don't know. We have some coaches really moving away from more team meetings, and more of what we do are like little circles before and after practice where guys can connect in their units. We use captains, like we have like a captain's council or leadership council, that each guy is heading up 2 to 3 other guys, and they're supposed to be looking after each other. And it's one of our systems that we have with a lot of our teams. And the power in the teams that use this effectively is, you create a lot of opportunities before and after practice for guys to connect and learn about what's going on with each other and empathize with each other. And this is really important, because we understand, you want to help players understand each other's struggles. And there's a certain level of transparency in that. And it's not just like personal struggles at home, which is obviously part of it, but just, where do I need to grow? Like, where I need to grow as a person, as a player, is different than where this person needs to grow as a person or a player. And everyone's at a different stage. There's the basic standard of how we do things here, but we also understand that sometimes some people maybe struggle with that, their temper a little bit more, their emotional intelligence, or they struggle with the effort, the focus. But when you have an environment that you create where people are articulating their struggles and they're supporting each other, then I think when it comes back to it being fair, but not equal, I think the important piece here is they'll have a better understanding of why maybe that person's on a little bit longer of a leash, you know, when it comes to some of these things. I think that's really, really important, because they'll understand that person and that struggle. And they'll be less concerned with whether it's equal or not. And they'll be more concerned with actually how they can help those people as well.
That's great. I like that. And again, I want to quick hit a few things for you so we can get a bunch of things in with this, be able to help coaches. Let's start with this one. How long do you take to try and help teach someone before cutting them loose from your program?
Yeah, well, first off, there's no simple answer, but I would give you two ones. One that I think people might disagree with, but I'm going to go ahead and just throw it out here. I think there is something very profound about you making a statement and saying, you know what, this isn't for you. This isn't for you. And people moving on. And it, you know, that whole San Antonio Spurs, not a spur, like being very clear. It's a really powerful signal when we do cut somebody loose. So I think so often when we talk about resetting our culture, I think sometimes this is part of it. I think sometimes we have to say, you know what, you're just not what we're looking for here. So I think there's a real, real power in that. And I don't want to say that in a transactional way, but it also comes back to us living out our mission and staying true to our team. When it comes to these nuanced situations, whether it be within a season or outside the season of, you know, when do I come loose or not, I think you've got to focus on two big factors. One is the strength of your current culture. If you have a really strong culture, you're the New England Patriots, you can bring in Randy Moss, who struggles on every other team, and he's going to get in line for a few years. Okay, so you have to look at your current culture and factor in, can our culture sustain a player with these challenges? The second is you have to look at your coaching. You have to look at how strong of a coach you are and be honest. How strong are you with some of these things that we've talked about today on this podcast about really working with guys in the emotional moments, helping them to develop coping, helping them to drive behavior change and build good habits around, you know, whatever it is that they're struggling with. And those are two really, really big factors that I think we really need to look at when it comes to making that decision. Because if our culture isn't strong enough or our coaching isn't strong enough, then they will not succeed. They will not be able to thrive in our team. And then we're hurting the team. And honestly, we're not helping that individual.
How do you teach culture in practice or reinforce culture in practice?
Yeah, well, I think Mark Bennett's rule of three is an incredible way to, in practice, in the training session, really drive player leadership, like a player-led culture. I think that's that type of, those type of ways of developing a communication system where there's a common shared language that people are using within the session, not just on how to defend the ball screen, but on common language on how to actually support the standards of the program. That would be my first thing. I use the acronym ERN, encourage, remind, and notify. We talk about those as the three important pieces of elements of team communication. We're encouraging each other, very, very basic, but we got to move beyond being cheerleaders. We got to give each other reminders that, you know, things before action, because that's helpful to get us, you know, reminders, whether it be on a technical or tactical thing, or also just a behavior thing of, you know, showing up on time. And then notifications I took from, you know, Daniel Coyle's book, The Culture Code. He talks about airplane pilots. You always use like notifications, non-judgmental statements of what they're observing, you know? And so we're trying to take emotion out of a feedback and just, hey, you didn't sprint back on defense last time. Hey, you didn't hedge that ball screen properly or whatever it be. So we try to use that to give them a common language of how we can actually really take the stuff that we're trying to do as far as a nurturing environment where people feel safe, how we can do that within the practice. So I think that's the first component. I think, and the second thing is, you know, some people might be listening to this podcast going, oh man, this transformational coaching, it's kind of sounds kind of soft and all, you know, lovey-dovey. I think a lot of times people view it as that way. I think it's actually coming in and having really, really high standards and consistently raising those day in and day out. And it doesn't really matter where you start. It's just identifying, all right, this is where we are. We're the laziest team we've ever seen, or, you know, our work ethics at a 5 out of 10, based upon my scale. How can I help these guys to move it up one notch? And it's just consistently coming in and doing that. And to do that, it comes back to that, you know, enforcing those standards, enforcing those consequences, doing it in the ways that we, you know, I really advocate is a big part of that. that takes emotional and mental energy that I think so many of us as coaches run out of because we feel like we're the only ones that are doing it. So it comes back to some of the language that ERN and stuff. So it's, there's this, the support and accountability, they go hand in hand because we can't be the only one every day, day in and day out, driving our culture. We've got to empower the players to do that as well.
That emotional drain is such an important point. And I think the best coaches have that emotion for practice or after practice or whenever it may be, again, not to coach, but to do all this aftercare, this concept of circling back, this circles back to your coping and talking about that, but this aftercare. And sometimes I know leaving practice, I was so drained. I was like, oh, I'll deal with it in the morning. But that immediate aftercare is so important to keeping culture on track, keeping players obviously on board in terms of the things that you're trying to sell them on as a coach, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think what's really, really important is that we identify really where we need to spend that aftercare, like that attention to certain guys. And I'm a big advocate. I know of other, you know, top coaches out there that I really respect and are leaders in general that advocate for the importance of solitude. I think we get so, as I speak this, especially with the college coaches I work with, we're running from thing to thing. Like it's life, you know, even high school coaches, you're running, you finish practice, you're running to go pick up the kids or, you know, go catch, you know, this or that, or make time for family. But man, if we can just, even if it's just 10 minutes in the car, we're not listening to anything and we're just spending time in solitude, thinking, you know, really trying to think about our own thinking, think about each player, each person in our program. What do they need? What do they need right now? Where are they at? And just spending some time with our thoughts, 10 to 15 minutes every day. I'm a big advocate for that. A lot of the coaches I work with, we try to use journaling where they're just kind of a reflection process, just coming back to where I need to spend some of that time and that energy. I think that's a really important piece as well.
Good stuff. And does on-court synergy, can it happen without them being friends?
I don't think it's absolutely vital. You know, I wouldn't say that I have like lots of research or anything like that. So I'll just speak from my experience. And I'm working currently with over 25 programs this season. So I see a lot of programs out there. I see what the difference is, are and stuff. I would say there are certain people that are just, their personalities are going to connect more than others. And they're just going to be buddy, buddy. And I think maybe sometimes we try to force people to really like each other, kids to get along with each other really, really well. But I do think that we need to establish a culture where people respect each other and they empathize with each other. I think that's what matters the most. And whether they're hanging out as friends off the court a lot, that's debatable. I've read some stuff out there, some journals that have shown that there's absolutely no correlation between, I remember reading one study years ago about major league or premiership soccer teams. And just like, actually there was no correlation between how much their off court relationships or off the pitch relationships to their on court success. So I think there's actually a bit of research that shows that just the friendships isn't that important, but there's a level of respect that is.
I love that. Cause a lot of that led me a while ago to think that really culture is built in my practice more than it's built in these team cohesion events. Not saying don't do them. Just saying that those things were a little bit overrated in terms of me having to put a lot of effort into off-court events and put more effort into building the synergy, the cohesion, the identifying with the common purpose in support of each other on the court in practice. Because again, we practice way more than we ever have team meals, for example. Does that make sense, that thinking?
Yeah. And so I'm not like, you know, we do advocate like culture days where teams come in and spend 15, 30 minutes kind of covering some stuff. But I don't necessarily argue ever that that's where like the culture is built. I think it's sometimes where we can kind of impart some lessons around character and stuff to our team and maybe address some things. So I would agree with you on that. I think honestly, our interactions already that we already have, the bus trip, the team dinner that we already have, how we shape that to create more collisions and connections, I think that's where we can help build culture off the court, is really just being more intentional in those things. And I've seen, honestly, if you want to do something as a team that you feel like something, maybe help your guys connect and build your culture, just going out and serving other people. I've got a a couple coaches. A guy came on my podcast, Kevin Orr, and he's had a bunch of other coaches that he's helped implement this of just a day where they go out and they run a special needs basketball camp. And that has just been absolutely transformational. So I think things like that I'm an advocate for sure. But yes, how we operate within practice when it comes to our performance, that's where that type of culture is really built.
You coaches build a program, you know, as you said, the right way. So what are some common shortcuts that maybe we should be aware of that we should avoid?
Yeah, I think one of the things is how we recruit or select players. I see this so much with coaches. They get into a situation, they really define some non-negotiables of how they want to be as a program and as a team. And then they look at this guy and he's very talented or skilled, or she's a really good shooter, or there's the drama of not bringing this player onto our team and what that will mean. And I think we start to see some slippage there. And those things just end up compounding and adding up stuff. And I think more often than not, I have coaches that come back, gosh, I really should not have let her or let him stay on the team. Like I really shouldn't have, or we shouldn't have recruited them. Then, man, we really missed out an opportunity there. I don't think, I see a lot more of that. So I think how we assess talent, we need to really be more intentional that we're assessing talent or we're selecting our team based upon the culture we want to build. I think that'd be a big thing. And also, I think we get really narrowed in on the short term. We really, you know, not just even the stuff that we were talking about, like the short-term effective yelling and stuff to get kind of these results and stuff, but we really get hung up on Friday, like Friday's game. Like we're really hyper-focused on that, our Saturday's game, the next game. And we start to maybe sacrifice, you know what, we just need to get this drill in, or we need to get this play in, or we need to get this in, instead of actually addressing certain other behaviors that shouldn't be negotiated. And so one thing I did years ago, Chris, was I implemented something called like my team quick set. And I took this from a coach down in Georgia, who's a state championship coach. I think Gene Durden is his name. I remember hearing him in a PGC clinic, and he talked about 10 quick drills that he did for a minute each. Just kind of their warm-up. I turned mine into 5 drills, 1 minute each. And I had the players set the standard of what essentially great would look like, or what excellence would look like in that drill. And we would reset the drill the second one person didn't do what they said they were supposed to do. And it was just a simple way for us to make sure and set the tone of every practice. Hey, we're not going to sacrifice our culture today. We're not going to sacrifice, because effort and attitude and focus and communication, these things matter to us. And for the first 5 minutes, we're going to get it right. And sometimes that quick set might last 20, 25 minutes. Usually it would just go a few extra minutes on a few resets, but it was a powerful thing that I started probably about 5-6 years ago that I truly believe sent a signal to our team that culture was going to come first and we weren't going to allow slippage in that practice.
I know you agree with this, so you're going to be okay with me saying that. When you talk about perfection drills, though, you're talking about them in terms of culture building. And I want to clarify that for coaches, because all the skill acquisition motor learning research would indicate that there's no new learning happening in perfection drills. So they aren't really team improvement drills. So I love that you phrase that, because that's kind of how I say it to coaches. Like, there's nothing wrong with perfection drills, but they're culture drills. They're not team, we're getting better as a group in terms of on-court. That makes sense, like how I'm saying that? Or do you have a better way of phrasing it?
Well, absolutely. So and I'm not a big drills guy right here, but those drills were our warm up to every practice and our warm up to every game. And it consisted of 5 minutes and just guys moving around. And what were the success criteria in the drills? It was using the man's name when you call for the ball. They were sprinting the back of the line. They were things like high fiving your teammate when you get the back there. And maybe one of those at the end might be you got to make 10 layups in like a minute, in that minute. Because like a full court layup drill, something like that. And the behavior, it was all really focused on the behaviors. It might be a technical thing, you know, on your jump stop or something like that every once in a while. But that technical thing was just more emphasizing player focus, because we all knew we were all capable of doing that if we focus. So that's, yes. And we use that as a culture piece.
I love that they are 1 minute. And just throughout this whole podcast, so many actionable ideas. And that's why I cannot encourage coaches enough to check out all your blogs, and you've been on other podcasts and your book and all the different sharing that you've done. But one thing, coach, I want to re-emphasize and come back to, because I know it's the blowback on some of these things with the Mark Bennett podcast, with your podcast, with me saying a lot of things I say. And that's that coaches feel sometimes like we're soft and we're not pushing kids, we're not challenging kids, and we're not holding them to a high standard. What do you say to that?
Yeah, I mean, that is right. That's a very common misperception of this type of coaching. And I honestly believe in the coaches that I work with that are using this type of coaching, understand it, that this is much, much tougher, because you're still giving them truth. You're giving them the truth. You're telling them how it is, but you're just delivering that in a different way. And it's so important. I mean, at the bottom line of what we're doing with every team is we're helping them to choose where they want to go, what they want to achieve, what they want to accomplish, who they want to become as a team. We're working with every player to help them identify what they want to achieve, who they want to become. And once we've empowered them to clarify that, we're there walking alongside them, reminding them, encouraging them, supporting them, and holding them accountable for that every single day. And without question, right? So it is emotionally, and we talked about this earlier, it's emotionally and mentally exhausting to do this. That's why I'm such a big believer of how we develop our staff to make sure they're on board with it. That's why my mentorship program has become a staple of so many coaches' programs, just because they understand how important it is that we have certain people speaking into our lives to help us to kind of push through this and keep going. But you know, it's not just emotionally and mentally exhausting. I'll say this though. One other aspect of it is it is very, very fulfilling. You know, you just feel more at peace at the end of the day, I think, with so much of your interactions. It's more of who we all want to become as coaches. And it comes back to more of living out and fulfilling our purpose as coaches.
Well said. And, you know, I cannot encourage coaches enough to go check out thriveonchallenge.com, articles, book, events, and mentorship program. And just, again, learn more about what you do and how you do it. And, you know, as you said, the whole point of all this is to stimulate your thinking so that we all do a better job in service of the players. And thank you so much for taking the time and spending with us.
Yeah, Chris. Well, I appreciate the opportunity, because the community you've developed at Basketball Immersion, very much like some of the Thrive on Challenge community, there's actually some crossover I know with some coaches, and people just consistently asking the question, is there a better way of doing this? And the answer is almost always yes. There is always a better way of doing things, and we're just constantly learning and growing. So it's just really special to be a part of this community in this way. So I appreciate the opportunity.
Coach, it is finally here. Go to www.dougnovakbasketball.com today to get 3 all-access practices, a finishing video, and a full team film session from one of the best basketball educators in the world, Doug Novak of Bethel University. Open the doors and get full access to 3 practices, 1 full unedited film session, and a point of attack instructional finishing video. That's www.dougnovakbasketball.com to learn more, or go to www.bivideoproductions.com to see all the ways we are sharing the game.
To find out more about Coach and all we spoke about today, please take a look at the show notes for today's episode. I love to share the game and have basketball coaching conversations, so connect with me on social media. You can find all my social media information and all your membership, clinic, and consulting needs at basketballimmersion.com. That concludes today's episode. I know there are so many podcasts out there. Thank you for taking the time to listen to the Basketball Podcast with me, your host, Chris Oliver. Please subscribe and share the podcast with your friends and colleagues so that we can keep bringing you the best of what's out there and share the game.